Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 26th of May, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, from the Construction Index magazine, and our online news editor, Phil Bishop. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
Well, I'm fine. I'm just waiting, anxious for winter to finally end and for spring to start.
We've got a bank holiday weekend this weekend, and certainly in this neck of the woods, we're promised some reasonably good sunshine. But the
yes,
garden is full of weeds, so I need something to get me out there and start pulling them all up.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I was just telling our producer Ben that they're predicting soaring temperatures of 21 degrees down here in Devon. So I'll believe that when it happens. But at the moment, it's still bloody cold. Anyway, let's warm things up with an interesting discussion, shall we? Ever hopeful. What's caught your eye this week?
Well, there's a few things. I think we could break it down, really, this week's chat, into two sections. First is on, there's two or three innovations and R&D projects and techie things, which I think are interesting. And yeah. Then later on, let's move on to talking about the whole subject of back to the office that we've talked about before, working from home and hybrid models of working in the future and who's going to work where when. And there are two or three stories on that topic that we can chew over as well relating to that.
Right, but okay.
First off, I know how much you love HS2, but one of the great things that's happening out of HS2, as big a project as it is there is quite a lot of innovation being demonstrated on the project. HS2 mm-hmm. itself as a client is very keen to promote things that save the planet, save money, save time, save anything that's good.
Save their reputation, yeah.
You see. Anyway, so the one that's out this week that they've talked about, which I think is a brilliant idea, and yet it's such a simple idea. I wonder why no one's done it before, which is it's a new piling technique. They're calling it zero mm-hmm. trim piling. For poured concrete piles, where you let's not assume that everyone's. My mother said she might listen today, so I have to dumb things down. Sorry, Mum. She won't know.
She's not going to thank you for that.
Well,
Phil.
She's not, but she won't know what the difference between a driven pile is and a board pile is. So anyway, okay. Mum, when you drill a hole and you pour concrete in it and it sets. Normally they put in too much concrete to make sure they got enough, and it's quite a job to cut the pile to the right length so it doesn't stick up mm-hmm. out the ground too much. Now, remarkably simple idea is not to put too much concrete in. Now, anyone who's done a concrete pour will know it can be quite a tricky thing to switch off the flow at exactly the right moment and have just the right amount. But what the a team on HS2, it's actually Cementation are the people behind all this. Cementation Skanska, who are a piling specialist. They have brought in what's called a suction excavator, which is basically a big Hoover/Dyson lorry. Actually, probably more Hoover lorry, which exactly what it sounds like. It sucks stuff out. And suction excavators are often used for if you break open the highway and crack open the ground to lay a pipe, you can stick a hose in and suck out all the loose ground to clean out the trench instead of using a digger. And it's never been used, apparently. It's never been used, suction excavator, for sucking out wet cement, excess cement from a a board pile. And anyway, they've tried it here, and it works, and it saves an awful lot of time, effort, energy, money, etc. And it sounds fabulous. Anyone who's read about it, we posted the story on the Construction Index website, it's elsewhere as well, on Tuesday this week. And if you read it on that day, you will have missed, because I've only just added it again 24 hours later. There's a video that HS2 have put out, which is quite useful as well to look at, which gives a bit more flesh on it. It's also on YouTube, that video. World first vacuum excavation technique at HS2. It's not really about vacuum excavation. I mean, it is, but it's much more about piling. It's a piling technique. And it's just a way of removing the surplus material when it's wet instead of when it's set, where you have to use a heavy cutting tools.
In a way, it's like the obvious solution. Pour in a bit too much and then suck out what you don't need. The thing, I think, I can see why nobody's tried it before, if indeed nobody has tried it before, because the first thing that occurred to me, and they haven't actually explained this in the press release, and it's not in your story either, is what happens to the... Well, they sort of explain it. What happens to the wet cement that they suck out of the pile caps? Because I think some of it's sent away for lab testing, apparently. And
samples.
Samples. And some of it is reused elsewhere on site. The thing is, wet concrete has a habit of solidifying over time. And I don't know, if you're going along a whole line of piles, sucking out the excess, soon end up with a suction excavator packed full of wet cement, which is rapidly going off. So I wonder what they, you know, how they manage that, how they, because of course, you know, if it does go off inside your suction excavator, that's one suction excavator, I reckon. I don't suppose you can clean it all out. So I wonder how they manage it. I wonder how they manage the wet cement, whether they immediately spit it into something else, into a skip or something like that, and let it go off and then get rid of it somewhere else. That's the bit of the story which I think is missing at the moment. So I think I'd be quite keen to find out what that entails.
Well, what I like about what HS2 have done here, I've been critical of them in the past for the HS2 publicity machine for hogging all the credit for stuff that their suppliers have done. But they've while it is they who have authorised and put out the release of this story, they have piled all the credit exactly where it belongs, not just on to...
Pun intended.
No, apologies. Not just on to the subcontractors, Cementation Skanska and the Skanska Costain Strabag Joint Venture, SCS, the main contractor, but they've actually the named individuals, and I don't know these men, but Lee Piper, who is a senior work superintendent with SCS, with Skanska Costain Strabag, and where's the other man? Dion Lowe, who works for, he's a project director with Cementation. And it was actually apparently Lee Piper's idea, and he's quoted in the story. He's worked in the construction sector for more than 20 years, and he's seen the same piling techniques used all the time. And working with colleagues, saw an opportunity to try a new approach. And HS2 were happy with that. And Dion Lowe, the cementation, who's sort of the piling specialist, he said they did some trials with the vacuum excavator, suction excavator supplier company, which is a company called Hercules Site Services, who are based in Gloucestershire, I think it says. And they tried it, tested it, all worked, piles worked. Yep, ready to go, and they say they're going.
It's quite good of them to credit the individuals who actually thought the idea up.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a photo of these two men. I would like to put a photo of them up, so you know, give them a bit more glory.
Yeah.
But it's going to save apparently 60,000 working hours on just that one site. And Cementation doing a lot of piling, £95 million piling contract they've got for SCS on HS2.
Wow.
I don't know whether there are enough vacuum excavators out and about. It's a bit of a niche machine, a vacuum excavator. I don't know if there are enough knocking around for the whole piling or board piling industry to move in this direction or not.
I had a press release yesterday, actually, Phil, you probably had it as well, from a company who's just taken delivery of a new... I think it was a suction excavator. It was a very funky-looking machine.
Oh, I saw that.
And came in from Germany. Did you see that?
They got a breaker's arm on the back of it.
That's right.
So they can smash up the ground with the same machine and then suck up the
suck out all the waste. So I can't find the story at the moment. I've filed it away somewhere, but that will be appearing online fairly soon, no doubt, and also in the magazine. Yeah. So I as you say, suction excavation isn't new. And it is a fairly niche thing because, as you say, it's really used only for utilities, excavations, where you don't want to use a digger and rupture a gas main or something like that. So they just use high pressure air, don't they, to sort of break up the ground and then suck it out again. It's pretty clever stuff. But yeah, I've never heard of it being used to suck up excess concrete, so that's a new one on me. Anyway,
it sort of mirrors a technique that Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering pioneered 5-10 years ago or something, which they called zero waste piling, which is for concrete driven piles.
The opposite, but
the flip side of board piles, where you drill a hole and pour in wet cement, and these you just bang a reinforced concrete pole into the ground. And what they came up with the system, I think it was Yuntan, the Finnish piling rig manufacturer, Yuntan or Juntan, they're probably Juntan, I don't know how you pronounce it, I've only seen it written down, whereby yep. you bang the pile in, and then you need to cut off the top, what's sticking out, which still has to be done, but that's done mechanically. And the machine, the piling machine, uses what it's cut off as the bottom bit for the next hole. So it's not wasted.
No.
They then bang that into the ground, and so the top of one pile becomes the bottom of the next pile.
So they're not actually fused together. They're separate items, are they?
I don't know whether they bung in a bit of glue on there. I've only got diagrams in front of showing how it works. I don't suppose you need to fuse them together because the weight... You know, they just one sits.
Yeah,
if it's
just
the other.
Well, that's quite clever, I suppose. Yeah, I didn't know about that one either.
Grangemouth, they piled it apparently in Scotland. Asda supermarket, they did the foundation for that, and using this cutting system, they saved 3.6 kilometres of pile waste that would have otherwise been produced. So that's a lot on one particular project.
So tell us about the second technical story, because this is quite an interesting one as well.
Totally different.
In fact, this is a fascinating story.
Totally different, but another innovation, technical innovation, which we first wrote about last year that they were starting to trial it and they got a government grant for trialling. This is all about asbestos recycling. Most asbestos that is taken out of buildings or whatever, most of it's in the form of roof sheets. As we know, I'm not going to insult listeners' intelligence by telling them that asbestos is nasty and it does bad things. The fibres cut up your lungs and everything. So we know asbestos is bad. We've known it for a long time. But there's still a lot of it about. And most of it's in the form of roof sheets, and they all go to landfill because what else can you do with it? Until now. There's a company called Thermal Recycling, and they're based... Where are they based? Somewhere in the Midlands?
Good question.
Wolverhampton.
Yeah, there we are, you were right.
They've basically got a big oven, a kiln, which looks kind of like a container, you know, shipping container with lots of pipes all around it. They simply put in these asbestos sheets, put it in this oven, heat it to buggery, I think that's a technical term. Heat it to... Is there a temperature? I can't remember.
No, they don't give a temperature, but it must be bloody hot.
They seriously heat it up.
Yeah.
And basically, the asbestos ceases to be fibrous and it becomes something different. And they knew they could do this, and the whole part of the research was saying, right, this stuff that we get out of our kiln at the end... What can we do with it?
Yeah.
And the research project that's now completed, what they found that it's really good for is a cement substitute. Mm. I don't know if it's carbon-free, certainly low-carbon, cement substitute. It can't be carbon-free because you've had to use so much heat to create it in the first place.
Yes, of course. No, low-carbon, I suppose.
But it's asbestos-free when it's the waste comes out, it's crushed up, and it's a sustainable aggregate. And they're saying it's particularly useful for road building.
Hmm.
And they've had it all tested by a couple of third-party independent labs who said, they're calling it CalMag. Calcium, aluminium and magnesium is where it gets its name from, CalMag. And they're saying that, you know, tests have shown, we're ready to go and we can now do this commercially. So send us your asbestos roof sheets, and you can buy some cement substitute from us.
They want to sort of scale it up, don't they? Because what I think it's a prototype at the moment, isn't it? I mean, it looks like a very serious piece of equipment, this kiln. It's a sort of it's quite clever. It's got a sort of a travelling roof to it, which slides over, and then they just whack on the gas and burn this up. It did strike me as a bit ironic, though, when I watched the video and first heard about this, that the way they found of actually converting asbestos into something completely different was to burn it. And I always thought that the whole point of asbestos was that it didn't burn very easily.
Yes.
Clearly, I suppose if you heat it up enough, anything will burn. But I don't know if they're if it's simply just temperature. If it's simply just temperature, again, it's one of these, another one of these simple ideas. Why didn't we think of this before? They might inject other chemicals in order to act as a catalyst, or inject a gas into the kiln. I don't know. Maybe they've got a secret process, and that this isn't simply a matter of heating it up. But it's quite interesting because you see the stacks of wrapped up asbestos, all because you've got to triple wrap asbestos sheets to get rid of them. If you've ever dismantled an old shed and taken it to your local dump, you've got to triple wrap it in polythene and then take it off. Anyway, all this stuff is all packed up in the kiln, and then afterwards it's just ash, basically, sort of vaguely resembling corrugated roof sheets, but much smaller and all slumped down and grey, and it just turns into a powder. I mean, if this is true, because they also say that it's not just the asbestos cement sheets that they can treat. They can treat all types of asbestos. So I imagine they're talking about fibrous asbestos from insulation, industrial asbestos. It's just a simple matter of getting it and treating it. So it is potentially a solution to the whole asbestos problem, isn't it?
I'm sure there must be more to it than simply applying heat, because then they've got nothing to commercialise. Anyone can do that, I would imagine. The photo we've got, I haven't been to this this workshop in Wolverhampton that they've got, but the photo of the kiln, it's, as I say, it's covered in pipework, which must be applying more than just heat, I'm sure. So I hope they've got some proprietary knowledge, so otherwise it's hard to commercialise. If you can't make money out of it, no one's going to do it.
That's true, yeah. Well, I suppose if it really is a solution to the disposal of asbestos, then legislation could force people to do it, even if the commercial pressure isn't enough. So I think it's got a future. It certainly sounds extremely promising. So it's early days, obviously, because this is they've been testing it for about a year, I think, and they've now come out and said, yes, we can do this. It is commercially viable. So hopefully there will be some developments in the foreseeable future, and we can sort of follow that story. But I think it's extremely promising. So two really good simple ideas. Simple ideas are always the best.
The other one is the hunt for an idea. Our third story on tech topics is the hunt for an idea.
What's that?
This is something that our colleague Lisa Russell, who's the our international editor here at the Construction Index, dug out and found that Tampere University in Finland is working with Skanska of Sweden on an international project to try and find ways of reusing parts of a derelict, a condemned building in Tampere. And what they're trying to do specifically is find a way to reuse the reinforced concrete elements as a whole, not as raw material, but for something new.
So you reuse rather than recycle?
Yes. So it's basically deconstruct, I suppose, somehow, this concrete building, and either make another building or do something. And she quotes the boffin involved, "There are many questions to be answered. How do we deconstruct the elements from the buildings without damaging them? How do we assess their structural integrity? How do we recertify the salvaged elements and turn them into a product that meets the building code requirements? How can we turn items which are not of uniform quality into a viable business?" So
yeah, a lot of ifs.
There's a lot of questions there, and they don't have any answers. So we don't really have much to offer here, folks, other than say there's some people asking some interesting questions in Finland.
Do they say what sort of elements they're talking about? Are they talking about beams or slabs, or are they talking about sort of pre-stressed or post-tension concrete as well? Because that must be difficult to reuse, I would have thought. I mean, or are they just talking about concrete pavers? Dig them up and move them somewhere else.
But looking at the photo of the building, I would assume we're talking about precast slabs.
Right.
You don't tend to post-tension a building. Post-tension is in bridges, isn't it?
They use them in buildings as well. You know, especially the rather more advanced designs where you need very slender sections over long spans. They'll often use post-tensioning or pre-stressing there, certainly post-tensioning. So, yeah, I mean, maybe for the majority of modern buildings which have, you know, concrete suspended floor slabs, they'll be fairly standard reinforced concrete slabs, I imagine. And I would have thought you could probably just trim the ends. I don't know what's involved, but probably just trim the ends and reuse them. But you would need to test them, I suppose, to ensure that they are structurally sound. And maybe that's one of the biggest hurdles in order, you know, verifying their suitability for reuse. But again, you know, why not? So I imagine there must be lots of demolition companies that sort of break out, because, of course, demolition these days tends to be a rather more refined process than people normally think.
It's more about the recycling.
Yeah, exactly.
It's more about the recycling and the wrecking.
It tends to be more about dismantling. So I'm sure the buildings are being dismantled all the time, and somebody says, "Well, that's a perfectly good slab." Yeah, bung it in the crusher, or you know, or just.
But that's the point. It's normally all crushed up.
Yeah, they extract the steel and
recycled as aggregate.
Well, it is reused, but I suppose reuse is always better. Well, when I say reused, it's recycled. So the aggregate and the concrete itself is crushed for fill or something like that, and the steel is obviously scrap, and that can be melted down and used again. But obviously, if you can avoid having to do any of that, that's even better. Just take it out and use it in a new building. Reuse is always better than recycling, I suppose. So yeah, that's a good one.
Well, they're calling this project Recreate. Ooh. Is the name of the research project. The Recreate project. Not even reuse or recycling, it's recreation.
So, three good stories there, Phil. Technical stories. What else have we got?
Well, let's change direction completely. We still reading the papers. Believe that we might be going back to the office. Well, you and I aren't. We've been staying in our home offices for years now. But most normal people who are not yet back in an office, if they work in an office, are looking to be invited to return to their offices. And there are lots of nerves and so on about this. And there are various things that have come across my desk. I have... Actually, there's an employment lawyer who's pitched an article to supply for us, which I haven't received the finished article yet, but it's going to be an interesting subject. That she is warning that if you have had workers on furlough and workers who have been in the office all the time over these past 14 months, and the furloughed workers are going to be coming back, you need to be sensitive and aware and alive to the potential difficulties of the reintegration of furloughed workers back with the people who've been running the show for the past 14 months. Should the people who've been doing the, you know, keeping the business afloat for the past 14 months, should they be treated differently, better? Would that be, you know, how do you acknowledge their contribution without making the returning furloughed workers excluded? Will the returning people be made to feel welcome? Will new cliques might have developed around the office which the returners used to be part of and now somehow are excluded from? So the whole office politics, social dynamic of offices, mixing furloughed and non-furloughed people together will be fascinating to the outside observer, potentially a nightmare to line managers trying to so that's an interesting.
I can really see how that would play out, because you know, a lot of people have said over the last 15 months or so that, you know, oh, the lockdown was great. It gave me space. It gave me time. You know, I could do this, do that and the other. Obviously, that was only the case for a certain number of people. Most people didn't like it at all. But you can imagine somebody in an office thinking, you know, oh, you know, I've got all this responsibility. I feel motivated, you know, and it's a, you know, it's the spirit of the Blitz. Me and a few of my colleagues are now in charge and we've got to keep this thing going. And then all these people you haven't seen for the last year start coming back and throwing a spanner in the works, and your tight little clique, your little working unit is broken up, and you're no longer, if you like, a big fish in a small pond. You're a small fish in the big pond again.
And I can imagine that there may well be some people who have spent the past 14 months getting a qualification of some kind.
Yeah.
A very sensible thing to do if you're stuck at home off work. But if I've been in the office working hard and someone who's been absent for the past 14 months comes back waving a piece of paper that suddenly means that they're superior to me on a higher pay grade.
Yeah, you wouldn't like that. Watching,
you know, oof, that would put my nose out of joint,
yeah,
I think.
Definitely. Yeah, that's an interesting situation, something we're going to have to look out for, I suppose. Well, not you, me, but a lot of people in the industry are certainly going to have to watch for that, because I think that's inevitable. It's going to cause a few ructions.
We've talked in the past, on and off, we've talked on the subject of flexible working. We've had guests on talking about flexible working and home working and so on and so forth. And Arup, the consulting engineer with 6,000 employees in the UK, put out a statement last week, which I thought was interesting. I don't think they're alone in this, but they put out a statement which came across my desk, basically saying that their hybrid model, they're calling it Work Unbound. Mm-hmm. For it's all employees across UK, India, Middle East and Africa, which I guess is EMEA plus India. They're basically saying almost you can work when and where you want, as long as you, you know, do the job, put the contracted hours in. If you want to do the work at evenings and weekends, that's fine. You know, if sun's shining on Tuesday and you want to say, sod it, I'm off to the golf course, the sun's shining, you can do that as long as you do the work on Saturday, which to me is eminently sensible, so long as there's not a deadline that you're missing.
Yes, of course.
But it's not quite as absolutely flexible, as they're saying. The staff will be allowed to work from home or remotely, wherever they want, from the beach, I guess, if they want, for up to 3 days a week. So you've still got to go into an office somewhere 2 days a week.
Very wise, I reckon.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think it's a good... I don't even think it's a compromise. It's just a pragmatic... Yeah, it's a good system.
Well, I mean, you could just disappear without trace and, you know, maybe just go a little bit quiet and people not notice that you're actually on an extended holiday.
I think that's pretty hard these days with,
well, I don't know,
with Zoom meetings, Teams meetings and all of that, that people have to be
well
on
this
all the time.
This story actually reminded me of something I saw on the BBC. I think it was only last month, it was quite recently, which was a story about a hospital employee in Italy, in the city of Catanzaro in southern Italy, a hospital employee who stopped turning up for work in 2005 and has reportedly been paid about €500,000 in the interim and hasn't turned up and done a stroke of work ever since. And that strikes me as the ultimate inflexible working, you know. I imagine, and then...
Give that man a medal.
I don't know what his job was in this hospital. I assume that he wasn't a brain surgeon or a specialist, probably just a hospital porter or a clerical worker. But yeah, I thought that was quite an achievement. It reminded me, I don't know if you ever used to watch The Sopranos, but there are certain scenes in The Sopranos where they were running some sort of construction racket, and in order to satisfy the American Inland Revenue, certain people who had no work jobs would turn up on site, sit around on garden chairs on site drinking beer all day, and then pick up their paycheck. You remember that?
I do. I did see that. I'm not entirely convinced that's exclusive to the USA. It might not happen that much anymore, but I think there have been plenty of scams and strokes pulled in the UK construction industry.
Yes,
over the years.
Probably. Well, you've got this fluid workforce. I suppose it's very easy to play the system. But I think that Arup are very wise to insist that these people at least show up a couple of times a week in order to prove that they're still actually employed. But otherwise, great idea. Working evenings and weekends, and as we've said many times on this podcast over the last year, people have got used to the idea and it works for most of us. So, great idea, I think.
Do you remember just before Christmas last year, we had on Emma Stewart, the chief executive of
TimeWise.
On Reconstruction on this podcast, talking about how flexible working, which is not just about working from home, it's about being able to go in late, stay late, leave early, go in early, and all the other sort of aspects of flexible working could be adopted in the construction industry. Because TimeWise have been working with Build UK and various contractors to develop a BAM, I remember one, or was it BAM Nuttall BAM?
Oh, yes.
And a couple of others, on pilot projects to make flexible working work for construction companies. And as we can imagine, we've discussed this before, it'd be quite doable in an office environment. And on a construction site, it more subtlety and more creativity might be needed. And another former guest of ours is Steve Hadley, the chair of the Federation of Piling Contractors, has got in touch with TimeWise and said, yeah, we want in on this. So the Federation of Piling Specialists is now working with TimeWise to develop perhaps a methodology or a guide or some sort of framework for adopting flexible working practices within the site operations of piling contractors. How they can enhance employee well-being without impacting productivity. You've always, need people on site to do the job, but how can you give them a little bit of freedom to respond to other things that they need to do with their life, whether it's care for children or old folks or whatever else is going on. And so that'll be an interesting project. Sort of, it moves on from what TimeWise has been doing with major contractors onto the piling specialists. So it's that's quite interesting.
I noticed, though, that the chief executive of TimeWise was quoted as Melissa Jameson this time around rather than Emma Stewart. So I'm assuming that there's a job share going on here.
Oh, I don't know. I missed
that. She
was
quoted, TimeWise chief executive Melissa Jameson was quoted. And yes, as you say, Emma Stewart was a CEO when we spoke to her. But maybe they job share. It would be entirely appropriate.
Yes, Emma Stewart is now co-founder and development director. She's listed as, and Melissa Jameson is.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. There's been a slight shuffling. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Lots of bosses. Yeah.
Okay.
And finally, on the subject of going back to the office, I was taken by something that a property developer, Helical, own lots of properties in London and Manchester, I think, including the Bowyer development at Old Street. And they announced their financial results this week, which are less interesting to me than what the chief executive, Gerald Kay, was saying about looking to his crystal ball about the office of the... Well, it's not even the office of the future.
The future of the office, really.
But more than that, it's more about the present. What particularly blue chip companies, your big accountancy houses and your firms like Arup's, the kind of office that they expect to have, they expect it to be green and sustainable and all that sort of stuff, and healthy air conditioning. They want broadband and tech in there and lifts at work and all the kind of obvious things. But what I thought was particularly interesting is he talks about an increasing hotelification.
Yes.
So I like that. He doesn't explain, but you know exactly what he means. Hotelification of office buildings with five-star management necessity. You know, attractive working environment with food and beverage facilities close at hand. And I thought that's interesting that the offices of the future are going to look more like hotels.
Well, yeah.
But I remember visiting, and I'm trying to think what is the theme park where somewhere around the A3 meets the M25? Is that Lightwater or?
I can't remember.
Anyway.
Chessington, yeah, probably. I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Never been there. I've only been past it.
Well, it's built in an old quarry pit.
Oh, right, okay.
Rather like Blue Water Shopping Centre. Yeah. And I can't remember, now, again, memory playing up, but we're going back 30 plus years when I visited the cement manufacturer who occupied, name me some big cement manufacturers, it'll come to me. Who are the big cement companies?
Blue Circle, Rugby, Castle. Well, those are the old ones. Yeah. I mean, it's Cemex.
Might have been Castle. Can't remember.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, they had a spanking, shiny, new office building with reception desk as you walk in, and behind the reception desk was a glass wall, behind which was a swimming pool.
Really?
And this is 1980s we're talking about, with effectively a big cement company having a swimming pool in the reception area. I thought you got to be particularly brazen to strip down and do that in the foyer of a lobby of a big construction materials company. I wish I could remember who it was. Someone tell me.
Are you sure they didn't just sort of take over an old leisure centre and turn it into their office?
No, it's purpose-built. I think it's all done at the same time as whatever the theme park that was being built next door was. And this is all, you know, I think they anticipated the hotelification of the office building. They're 40 years ahead of the curve, so well done them.
Well, I can see that they're going to have to do this because, you know, people do want better facilities. I mean, this chap, Gerald Kay, as you said, I mean, when I first saw the headline, I thought that it was all about turning offices into hotels.
Which is also happening.
Didn't realise it was actually... Well, yeah, which is also happening. But no, he was talking about four key trends which he'd identified. One was sustainability, and that built, you know, the office of the future will need to be, you know, less, you know, more carbon efficient, if you like, and more energy efficient. Wellness was the second one, and that meant better heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, basically a more a healthier working environment. Technology, which was stuff like sort of using clever technology, building management systems to minimise energy wastage, that kind of thing, and also to enhance the working environment, and enhanced amenity, which, as you said, being able to get a nice meal there, you know, food, drink, club-style changing facilities and bike racks. And I think, actually, those last two are really important, increasingly important, actually, because a lot of us are being asked to, you know, cycle to work or walk to work or jog to work if we can.
If you're a young person, you've got, and you live in a built, you know, a private rental flat in the middle of a city, you've got, if you can afford a car, you've got nowhere to park it. No one will let you park it anywhere. So you have to cycle to work. And if they expect you to cycle to work, when I used to work in offices, there was always some people who would cycle to work, no shower amenities there. And it wasn't always great, to be honest.
No, that's true. No, I can remember working in central London and, you know, you'd come in the morning, there'd be somebody standing there in his underpants having a wash down because there's no shower available, and then climbing into his suit. Yeah, it was... So that sort of facility, I think, increasingly is going to be expected by people who are being asked to work in offices. And, yeah, have a nice cafe, a restaurant, something like that. You may be tempted to hang around a bit afterwards. It'd improve the social aspect of the office environment. So I think that's good as well. And a swimming pool, of course.
I think I'd rather, it's a bit like, I wouldn't want to eat in the staff canteen if you're going to have a not just have a sandwich at your desk. It's a bit like when you go on an all-inclusive holiday, you think, well, we have to stay in the resort because we paid for it. It was actually much more fun to go to a different little, you know, taverna or trattoria or whatever it may be every evening around the town.
But if it's, I mean, if it's more than just a canteen, I mean, my daughter works in Bond Street, and her office is on top of a branch of Pret a Manger, so you know that's where she goes for lunch, and it's not seen as being like the staff canteen. It's obviously it's a separate business, but it's right on site. They get a bit of a discount, I think. But if you had your own Pret a Manger in your office, which provided similar sort of facilities, I'm sure that people would use it rather than just queue up with a plastic tray.
I think there's going to be a big market for that. I mean, Pret a Manger are talking about putting concessions into various places. And just as we've seen, you know, familiar names, whether it's Subway or whatever sandwich provider, into petrol stations and university campuses, I think we can expect to see them turning up in office blocks. Mini concessions.
Absolutely. I have to admit, I never liked working in offices. I mean, I worked in some fairly nice offices, I suppose, but the office environment I never found particularly amenable. I mean, maybe that was just me. I'm sure that most people thought it was fine. Did you ever work in Rosebery Avenue?
I did.
You did? Do you remember the coffee pods? Now, this is back in the days when a pod was something completely different. It was a spec office built in Clerkenwell, Islington.
For listeners who aren't in with the construction trade press, Rosebery Avenue housed simultaneously Architects Journal, New Civil Engineer, Construction News, Ground Engineering, Building Products, International Construction Today. What other ones were in there?
Yeah, the Architects, there's AJ, and there was the Art Market one. I can't remember what that was. Architectural Review, I think. But anyway, so yes, it was and it was a spec office, which hadn't been designed for anybody in particular. And we were all decanted in there. And they didn't have much in the way of facilities, I seem to remember. There was actually nowhere to make coffee or tea or even get a drink of water. There were toilets at the end of the corridor, and that was it. And so they brought in some interior designer, specialist designer, to create these little, we just dubbed them pods. Because they were like elliptical sink units with a built-in kettle sink, I don't know, worktop, that kind of thing. Do you remember those? And the carpet surrounding it was covered with coffee stains.
I don't remember.
It looked nice to begin with.
I think
with.
I might have moved on by then. I have no memory of that.
Yeah, you probably didn't like the environment. But no, that was not an ideal environment, all open plan, very noisy. I think you know, club style changing and a dedicated cafe or restaurant would have been much better, but you can't have everything. Well, have we reached a logical conclusion there? I'm not sure it's logical, but have we reached a conclusion?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, better get back to my no work job now, I guess.
Well, that's the future offices and whether we're going back to them or not. We know we're not, David. We're going to carry on working from home. And frankly, I think we're reasonably happy to carry on doing so. Anything else on the agenda? Anything else we want to talk about today?
No, nothing that I think is really pressing or can't wait for next week. So I think that's about it for now.
Well, I'm quite excited. Next week, I am actually getting out of the house, getting out of the office, out of the house, out of the village. Next week, I am. I have been invited, along with the rest of the press, I believe, to visit the one of the HS2 sites. HS2 site. Edge of the M25.
The Chiltern Tunnel. The tunnel
exactly.
Portal, isn't it?
South portal of the Chiltern Tunnel, a line joint venture. They're just about to launch one of the first huge great tunnel boring machines, and I am really quite excited about that. I first of all, I've got to such is the life of these days, and I'm sure lots of listeners will have to do this every day, I dare say, but I've not been doing it. I've got to take a lateral flow test, log it on the government app, download, upload, prove that I'm fit, well, sane and healthy and all of that, and I'll get on site, and I can't wait. So I'll tell you all about that, maybe not next week, maybe the week after. We'll talk about that trip.
Yeah,
say that for another day. But for today,
jolly good.
Are we done? All talked out?
Yeah, I think we
Brilliant.
Are. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. This has been David and I for another week on Reconstruction. See you next week. Cheerio.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.